WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Bright Lights, Big City is considered the first novel to chronicle the New York downtown club scene of the 80s. It's about a young writer from the suburbs making his way in the city. He loses his job and his bearings after too many nights spent partying until morning, sniffing too much cocaine. Bright Lights, Big City inaugurated the Vintage Contemporaries paperback series, became a bestseller, and was adapted into a film starring Michael J. Fox. A novelist, Jay McInerney, became one of the most talked-about young writers of the 80s. McInerney's second novel, Ransom, was set in Japan, but he returned to New York nightlife for his new novel, Story of My Life. It's narrated by a 20-year-old would-be actress. She frequently misses her acting classes because she's been out partying late or up all night having sex with a new boyfriend. She and her friends live on their parents' checks and credit cards. Many of McInerney's readers expected him to get out of the club scene for his new novel, but McInerney thinks the setting of his new novel, Story of My Life, is actually very different from that of Bright Lights, Big City.
Well, it's I think of it as a somewhat different scene. It's Bright Lights, Big City is really about the beginning of the 80s and is set in the beginning of the 80s. And this is a, I suppose, a bookend to that book, Bright Lights, Big City. It's a darker and a scarier book, I think, although, again, I hope it's funny. But this scene, insofar as this is somewhat a book about the nightclub scene, I mean, this is an unusual kind of milieu and a kind of meetings spot, almost a melting pot, if you will. And New York is an interesting city in that people from a lot of different worlds tend to come together here in a way that they really don't in places like Washington and Los Angeles, where you essentially have company towns. And for better or worse, this idea of the nightclub, of there being a place that everybody wants to, that everybody feels is the center of the world, still has a pretty powerful grip here in New York, and it's a place where a lot of different people converge and intersect.
How is that scene different now than it was when you first wrote Bright Lights, Big City? Do you think the scene has changed a lot?
Well, yeah, there's a kind of real fin de siècle feel now. I mean, it is very self-conscious and somewhat exhausted, if you will. And yet, as I say, I think it maintains its grip. When I was, the period I was writing about in Bright Lights, Big City, which was really 1981, 1982 was the actual setting of that book, there was a kind of underground club scene at that time, particularly centered around the East Village. There were these places like the Mud Club, which were considered kind of salons for the avant-garde. They were not written about in New York Magazine. They certainly were not written about in Time Magazine. These were places that you had to know about, and it was a sort of a mark of hipness to know about them. There were places where musicians and artists, and yes, even writers would come together to try out their new haircuts and maybe even talk about their work, or that at least was the idea. And it was a very powerful myth. I mean, we wanted it to be like Paris in the 20s, I suppose, and to some extent, yeah, perhaps it was. I mean, there were people like the people who became known as the East Village artists, you know, Keith Haring and Jean-Michel Basquiat and Kenny Scharf were part of that scene. Musicians like Deborah Harry and David Byrne were the kind of people you were apt to run into as well. Now in the late 80s, I think, in a sense, everyone is trying to relive what might be perceived almost as a kind of golden era of that nightlife, and it's a lot more self-conscious. The places come and go even more quickly now, as everybody wants to be at the newest one. The whole idea of the new is something that keeps accelerating, and at the same time, it's not as much of an avant-garde scene. It is something that's covered so heavily by the media and watched so closely that you do have sort of hip stockbrokers sort of rubbing shoulders with Cher and and this sort of performance artist and low-life element is almost crowded out of the scene.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to read the opening from your new novel, Story of My Life. And the novel is written in the voice of the main character, Alison Pool.
Yeah, I should explain. I'm not going to read this in a soprano, but you'll just have to suspend your belief a little more than usual, perhaps. This is just from the beginning, a chapter called Getting in Touch with Your Child. I'm like, I don't believe this. I'm totally pissed at my old man who's somewhere in the Virgin Islands. I don't know where. The check wasn't in the mailbox today, which means I can't go to school Monday morning. I'm on the monthly payment program, because Dad says wanting to be an actress is some flaky whim, and I never stick to anything. This from a guy who's been married 5 times. And this way, if I drop out in the middle of the semester, he won't get burned for the full tuition. Meanwhile, he buys his new bimbo, Tanya, who's a year younger than me, a 450 SL convertible. Always gone for the young ones, haven't we, Dad? Plus her own condo, so she can have some privacy to do her writing. Like she can even read. He actually believes her when she says she's writing a novel. But when I want to spend 8 hours a day busting ass at Lee Strasberg, it's like another one of Allison's crazy ideas. Story of my life. My old man's 52, going on 12. And then there's Skip Pendleton, which is another reason I'm pissed. So I'm on the phone screaming at my father's secretary when there's a call on my other line. I go, hello, and this guy goes, hi, I'm whatever his name is. I'm a friend of Skip's. And I say, yeah? And he says, I thought maybe we could go out sometime. And I say, what am I, dial-a-date? Skip Pendleton's this jerk I was in lust with once for about 3 minutes. He hasn't called me in like 3 weeks, which is fine, okay, I can deal with that. But suddenly I'm like a baseball card he trades with his friends. Give me a break. So I go to this guy, what makes you think I'd want to go out with you? I don't even know you. And he says, Skip told me about you. Right. So I'm like, what did he tell you? And the guy goes, Skip said you were hot. I say, great. I am totally honored that the great Skip Pendleton thinks I'm hot. I'm just a jalapeno pepper waiting for some strange burrito, honey. I mean, really.
Well, this character's voice is obviously really clearly stated in your head. What made that voice so appealing, so interesting to you, that you wanted to write a novel in that voice?
Well, it's a voice that I hear all around me, and I have for a long time. I just didn't realize it until about a year ago, when I overheard a conversation taking place entirely in this dialect, what I think of as a sort of dialect of the American language. And it's really all around us. I hadn't really seen it in a book before, but I hear it everywhere. I hear it on the streets. I even hear it on television. And it has some curious features. It's almost entirely present tense, this particular dialect. And the speech verbs are all more like action verbs. You say, I go, you want to dance. And he goes, yeah, sure. As opposed to I said, she said, he said. Another one is, I'm like, what's your name? And he's like, my name's Dean. It's in some ways, I think, a very limited language. And then again, I think it's very, to me, it just has a certain music, a certain kind of rhythm. I think all idiomatic speech is potentially interesting. I mean, and the tradition of the idiomatic novel certainly goes back at least as far as Mark Twain in our literature. Huck Finn is not the most articulate guy in the world, and yet I find that language to be very beautiful. And in a sense, the limitations of this dialect kind of give the reader room to move around and sort of know more than the narrator knows.
This is a woman, this main character, who's on the whole pretty superficial and who has a really unusual sex life. She likes plenty of sex, but she doesn't necessarily take precautions against sexually transmitted diseases. But her big fear is that sperm has a lot of calories, so she has to be careful about oral sex because she was once slightly anorexic. What interests you in this character? I mean, it's obviously a pretty superficial character, but you find enough interesting in it to write a whole novel.
Well, I would take issue with that entirely.
Okay.
I don't think she's any more superficial than any 20-year-old girl
or
guy. I think she's very smart, and it's easy to confuse education with intelligence. In fact, Allison has not had a chance to get a Radcliffe education, partly because her parents just haven't really given her that kind of upbringing, although they've given her everything else. They've given her a lot of credit cards. They've given her horses and cars and so on. But I find her to be a very intelligent person underneath this veneer of kind of glib superficiality. And that was one of my challenges, was to try and give depth and likability to a character who at first seems a little shallow and maybe not so likable, a little bit like a spoiled brat. But in fact, I mean, Allison is keeping fast company, and she is a very acute observer of for instance, the guys that she goes out with tend to be, you know, 30, 35-year-old world beaters, bond traders and guys who own their own commodities companies. And I think Allison tends to be smarter than most of them. As much as she lives a kind of life which is faster, wilder, and crazier than, say, her average counterpart in maybe Ann Arbor, Michigan, I don't think that she's so radically different than that Midwestern girl, say. And sometimes I think you have to look at the extremes of a society in order to illuminate the middle. I also think her sex life is less unusual than you might... than you just indicated you felt it was. I think, I think we read a lot of feature articles about how sexual behavior in this country has changed. I don't see that to be the case myself.
That's interesting. My guest is Jay McInerney, and his new novel is called Story of My Life. He's also the author of Bright Lights, Big City and Ransom. Bright Lights, Big City is about a writer who's thrown off balance by the club scene and finally bottoms out. When you first got to New York, did you start gravitating to the clubs right away?
Well, I was actually living in Japan, and I started hearing about...
You were on a scholarship in Japan.
Oh, yeah, I was on a fellowship from Princeton University studying Japanese. I was also on my own studying martial arts. And I just started hearing about this art and music scene in the East Village, which interested me a lot. It had been... When I left the States for Japan in 1976, 77... It just seemed to me there was nothing happening culturally, politically, that things were kind of dead. And gradually, news started drifting toward Tokyo about, you know, a kind of little artistic renaissance focused around the East Village in New York that had to do, as I say, with sort of graffiti art, with new wave music. There seemed to be a new vitality in the arts around the late 70s, and New York seemed to be the center of that scene. And I came back for, I suppose, partly with that in mind, and in fact moved to the East Village.
How much did the status within the clubs matter to you, getting admittance to the VIP rooms, for instance?
Well, I never was... I was just a kid, and I didn't even know how to dress for that whole scene. I was really very much an outsider. I was just trying to soak up as much as I could of the whole scene. And I suppose I would have liked to have been an insider, but it was not an option for me at that time. I had to hang out with people who were much cooler than me in order to get to get taken in. And that's certainly, I think, true of the character in Bright Lights, Big City as well. Without Tad Allagash at his side, he wouldn't be getting into these places.
Was there a Tad Allagash character in your life, someone who was not only more into the scene but also a lot more corrupt?
Yeah, there has always been a Tad Allagash in my life, I think, and most of us probably. I like to think that many of us have a Tad Allagash in our life. You know, I've had about 10 of them myself, and there are various claimants to the role of model for Tad Allagash here in New York. Although, actually, I can think of one who's in Tokyo and one who's in Memphis, Tennessee, that are just as likely. But Tad is the guy who always seems to know what he's doing. He seems socially well-adjusted. He's cool. He at least gives the illusion of knowing, appearing to know what's going on. And I think most of us in our heart of hearts are insecure. And even if we don't, even if we secretly think someone like Dad is corrupt and superficial, we really sometimes want to be just like that. And so, I've had people like that in my life, and I always have felt myself kind of socially maladjusted, and I think that's an essential kind of part of the psychological makeup of being a writer. If you were really happy with the world as it is, then I don't think you'd go to all the trouble of reinventing it for 200 or 300 pages.
Well, in a moment, I'm going to ask you to read the opening of your novel, Bright Lights, Big City. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer Jay McInerney, the author of Bright Lights, Big City, Ransom, and a new novel called Story of My Life. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Jay McInerney is my guest. Jay, can I ask you to read the beginning, the opening paragraph of your novel, Bright Lights, Big City?
Sure. You're not the kind of guy who would be at a place like this at this time of the morning, but here you are, and you cannot say that the terrain is entirely unfamiliar, although the details are fuzzy. You're at a nightclub talking to a girl with a shaved head. The club is either Heartbreak or the Lizard Lounge. All might come clear if you could just slip into the bathroom and do a little more Bolivian marching powder. Then again, it might not. A small voice inside you insists that this epidemic lack of clarity is a result of too much of that already. The night has already turned on that imperceptible pivot where 2 a.m. changes to 6 a.m. You know this moment has come and gone, but you are not yet willing to concede that you have crossed the line beyond which all is gratuitous damage and the palsy of unraveled nerve endings. Somewhere back there you could have cut your losses, but you rode past that moment on a comet trail of white powder, and now you're trying to hang on to the rush. Your brain at this moment is composed of brigades of tiny Bolivian soldiers. They are tired and muddy from their long march through the night. There are holes in their boots, and they are hungry. They need to be fed. They need the Bolivian marching powder.
You know, we talked earlier about writing your new novel in the voice of the main character and writing in the kind of dialect that she speaks. This novel is first person, but written in the second person. It's written in the voice of the character, but it's written in the you instead of the I.
Yeah, second person singular.
Yeah, and it made me wonder if you talk that way to yourself.
I do, I think.
Do you?
Yeah, I think comparing notes with other people, I think most people do somewhat and don't notice it that often. It's only when you really catch yourself saying something out loud that I think you might realize that the second person form of address is pretty common kind of interior monologue. I don't think we go around saying I to ourselves.
Yeah, it just increases.
I'm crossing the street now.
Right.
And now I see the Plaza Hotel. You know, I think it's I think we're much more apt to, insofar as our kind of inner landscape has any grammar and syntax to it. I think that this is a way that people do talk to themselves, at least in English. I'm not sure about like Pushto or Russian, but a lot of people, when I say this, you know, will then sort of catch themselves a day or two later and say, "Oh yeah, you're right. I do talk to myself in the second person."
When you started writing Bright Lights, Big City, did you think that the voice and the subject was something that was going to be perceived as unique to your generation and that wouldn't translate to, say, older editors who might read the manuscript?
No, I just didn't see the subject matter as being that much of an issue. And to me, it was a background that I was familiar with, and it seemed I had been told that a writer should write what he knows. It's hard enough to write a novel and to deal with all the variables involved there, and it helps if you, you know, if you're dealing with a landscape that you're somewhat familiar with. But I guess I just didn't. I was just afraid that no one would be particularly interested in this. I mean, forget about my peers. I just thought, you know, maybe me, my editor, and a few of my closest friends might read it out of duty, but it didn't seem at the time like any kind of surefire thing, and we were all surprised by this popular response to the book.
Well, in fact, your novel is considered one of the first, or perhaps the first, books in what became almost a genre, in the sense of, you know, first person, present tense type books,
well,
with the club scene either as a setting or a backdrop.
I don't know. Well, insofar as that's a genre, it was the first. I don't like to think of this as a genre. I think there's been a tendency in the media to sort of lump fairly disparate writers together on the basis of our age and subject matter, which to me are the least interesting things about my work, they tend to emphasize the least interesting aspects of everyone's work when we start, you know, getting these sort of trend identifications.
Well, do you almost feel like you've been held responsible for shortcomings in subsequent novels written by other people?
I do, yeah. I feel that I get occasionally thrashed for somebody else's novel as if I were some sort of literary godfather. And I want to say, you know, hey, I didn't write that one, guys.
Your novel Bright Lights, Big City was made into a movie that was released earlier this year. And you wrote the first screenplay, the draft of the first screenplay. Then there were several other subsequent drafts written by other people.
About 17, I think.
Which is quite a lot, even for the movie industry. And then you ended up being brought in for the actual making of the movie after the movie had already gone through one director and a second, James Bridges, was hired. Did you feel satisfied with the final product?
Yeah, and I felt pretty happy with the final product. I mean, the process itself was nightmarish. And if I'd ever known what was involved from the beginning, I think I just would have said, you go off and make it by yourself, guys.
Which is kind of what they wanted to do, probably.
Yeah, well, I wrote three drafts, and then they stopped answering my phone calls for about 2 years. And then I heard it was being filmed in New York, and friends of mine were getting calls to have their lofts rented for locations, and I was feeling very much left out of it. Then that particular director was fired after, I don't know, 9 or 10 days of shooting, and James Bridges came in and rescued the project and called me up and said that he'd read the 18 or so drafts that there were extant, and he liked my first draft the best, and would I just come in and rewrite it with him so that we could... We were really doing it by the seat of our pants, because he started shooting 3 days after he took over the project, and initially there was virtually no script. We were really shooting straight out of the book. I think it was a happy experience in that sometimes it's better to do things quickly than this project already had dragged on for 3 years. So I think some of the sort of nervous energy that we all had having to shoot this movie in 6.5 weeks was conveyed on the screen in a positive way. And it was fun to be working that directly. Most screenwriters hand in their script and they never hear from anybody again, but I was going down to the set every day and rewriting lines if need be. And I was also a little bit involved in the editing process. In the end, I had a very happy collaboration. The first three quarters of the experience I could have done without.
What was your reaction when you found out that Michael J. Fox was going to play the main character? And I ask that since he had a reputation for being a fairly conventional actor because he was most identified with family ties on TV.
Well, my first reaction was that I didn't get it.
How he could fit the character.
Yeah. But then again, I'd only seen one episode of Family Ties. So I may not have had as much of a problem as people have been watching the show for 5 or 6 years every day. My second reaction, I guess, was that that Michael Fox might be a very good person to do the role, because it was going to be really important when we put this on the screen, getting people to identify with this character right off the bat, who's doing some unsympathetic things. In the book, you're inside his head. You have no choice. You have to identify with him. But in the movie... the movie camera is of necessity outside of everybody's head, and you have to have somebody who can sort of jump right through the lens and grab the heart of the audience, and that's something that Michael J. Fox, I think, has demonstrated many times that he can do. He's a very sympathetic person, and it seemed important to me for the message of this movie, insofar as there's a message, that... some people might have envisioned a kind of unshaven Mickey Rourke in this role, but this guy is a pretty, he's not so far from being the boy next door. And the point is, this could be the guy who grew up next to you, or mom, this could be your son. He's not some kind of lunatic. He's extremely well-educated. He's a middle-class boy. He's maybe a little smarter than the average guy who flunked his SATs, but he's not a derelict. He's not a prodigy of any kind, and I think it was important to have someone as sympathetic and someone who looked so much like the boy next door as Michael J. Fox in order to get this point across.
You worked as a fact checker at The New Yorker for about 7 months, and that experience is alluded to in Bright Lights, Big City. Did you ever do anything that really hurt the reputation of The New Yorker, like your character in the novel did at his magazine?
No, I don't think so. I got a few things wrong here and there, and the whole point of the fact-checking department is that any little slip-up is the end of the world. That's the attitude you have to have if you're going to be a fact-checker. You know that You know, their proper noun misspelled is reason to hang your head in shame and commit harakiri, you know. And I just didn't quite have that attitude. I was always more interested in an interesting lie than in a boring fact.
Have you nevertheless used any of your fact-checking skills in your work as a novelist?
I did learn how to research material pretty quickly and efficiently. But in general, I think they're kind of antithetical occupations. And I am a storyteller and not necessarily a kind of lover of raw facts. It's really a completely different mentality, and clearly I discovered where my sympathies lay. As I say, you know, tell me a good yarn any day, and I don't care if the facts are right or not.
Do you feel that there have been any false assumptions about who Jay McInerney is based on who the characters are that you've created?
Well, I think that people just assume that I'm the main character in Bright Lights, Big City, and I get a little tired of people calling me at 3 in the afternoon and saying, "Oh, did I wake you up?" you know, I mean, this sort of formulaic identification of a novelist with his protagonists, I think, is pretty naive. And clearly the guy who is in Bright Lights, Big City would not have been able to sit down and write the book. I mean, he would have, at the very least, had to become somebody else in order to do it. I suppose that's one reason that in my new book I've decided to kind of hide behind a female character. I really exhausted my interest in for the moment, in writing about young male protagonists, people who do take off from aspects of my own character, and I wanted to put myself into the shoes of a woman.
So there'll be no confusion?
Well, I hope not.
Okay.
I think people would have to really stretch to imagine me as a 20-year-old aspiring actress, but then I don't know.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
My guest has been Jay McInerney, the author of Bright Lights, Big City, Ransom, and a new novel called Story of My Life, which just been published by Atlantic Monthly Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.